Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Hello and welcome to Right Now Radio. I'm your host, Anna, and with me in the studio is Evelyn.
Hello, everyone.
And the time is now just after 6 o'clock, and we'll be talking all things human rights throughout the next half an hour. And tonight we'll be looking specifically at a new initiative. It's the Climate Change and Environmental Law Panel, essentially a group of barristers committed to improving access to legal advice and advocacy in public interest litigation involving climate change and the environment. And joining Evelyn and me in the studio to discuss the work and the aims of the panel is Jane Treleaven, a Melbourne barrister. Thanks for coming in, Jane.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And before we have a bit of a chat to Jane, let's have a quick update on all things human rights news and events. We've got some great events coming up. They're February events. It's been fairly quiet in January with everyone away at the beach, but coming up, first of all, is the Human Rights and the Caston Centre for Human Rights Law presentation called Preying on the Poor, Vulture Funds, Debt Relief and Human Rights. It's going to be held on Thursday, the 10th of February, and it will be held in the city at the Monash University Law Chambers. And it's a free public seminar, which is pretty impressive because Dr. Cephas Lumina, who is the UN independent expert on the effects of foreign debt on human rights, is going to be speaking on the topic of foreign debt and its impacts on the human rights of those in developing countries. So to be able to attend that free is a pretty good deal. So if you're around on the 10th of February, contact the Caston Centre. Their number is 9905 3327, and RSVP by the 4th of February. The second very interesting event or lecture that's coming up, and in fact I've looked at the date for this and it's in March, not February, Friday the 4th of March, again a lunchtime seminar. It is more appropriate for those with a larger budget. It's not free, but I think it will be well worth the money. It is a lunchtime lecture celebrating International Women's Day. The guest speaker, Mary Costakidis, and she's talking about the price of courage. Has freedom of information gone too far? And it's really looking at the media coverage regarding WikiLeaks founder and editor-in-chief Julian Assange and what that means for people that are prepared to speak out and expose the wrongdoings of those in positions of authority. So that no doubt will be interesting. The Law Institute of Victoria is the body responsible for registering for that event, and I would recommend that you visit their website www.liv.asn.au. In terms of events, it's very timely because today, in fact, Australian officials will appear before the UN's Human Rights Council in Geneva for what is known as the United Nations Universal Periodic Review process. This is a process that involves the 192 member countries of the United Nations, each of which are required to undergo a review. It's a four-yearly review, and it aims to examine every aspect of a country's human rights record. And it's a peer review in that the other 191 member countries of the UN will today be examining and questioning Australian officials about domestic human rights performance. Of course, it's anticipated, no surprises, that the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will be heavily scrutinised, particularly in light of the Northern Territory intervention, which of course overrode Australia's laws regarding anti-discrimination and racial discrimination.
We will not negotiate with minor state of title government or anyone on our culture, on our land. You know, if people say, oh, you're going to finish up with nothing, well then so be it. But at least our hearts will tell us that we did not sell out our country and our culture and heritage for a few scungy dollars.
Subscribe to 3CR so that your dollars support Indigenous voices and the struggle for land justice.
For Aboriginal people, the greatest grief of all is seeing the country destroyed. And somewhere along the line, we have to realise that we don't actually have the right to do that, that nothing we've ever done has given us the right to do that. Now, you know where I stand on this, because I'm so simple-minded, I think we've just got to admit that this is an Aboriginal country. Just do it.
You're listening to Right Now Radio on 3CR, 8:55 a.m. and the time is now 10 past 6. And tonight we'll be looking at the Climate Change and Environmental Law Panel, an initiative aimed at increasing or enhancing access to justice around climate change and the environment. And with us in the studio, as introduced previously, is Jane Treleaven, a Melbourne barrister who sits, I think, as secretary on the panel. Is that right, Jane?
Yes, it is.
Terrific. Thanks so much for taking the time to come in and have a chat. I know that talking is something that you're used to doing at the bar, so you'll no doubt be able to entertain us with what looks like a fantastic new initiative. And I thought perhaps the best way to start might be by telling our listeners a bit about what on earth the Climate Change and Environmental Law Panel is all about, who's involved and what are the aims of the panel.
Thanks, Anna. The panel was launched in March last year and loosely is a collection of barristers who practice at the bar, who have volunteered to make themselves available to provide pro bono legal assistance, so advice and representation, to environmental groups or others who may wish to become involved or are involved in environmental litigation, which is deemed by our guidelines to be public interest litigation.
Right, so it might be perceivable that you'd have a local community group that perhaps has an interest in a particular environmental issue that's affecting their local community that might come to you and say, we think this has got a broader public interest aspect to it. Can you assist us? Is that the sort of thing that the panel...
It would depend. Those local community groups often can cross a fine line because often they are private landholders who are more interested in their local community amenity and not necessarily the public interest aspects of the proposed development or something along those lines. So there are guidelines that the panel has that they must meet in order to be able to obtain assistance. The guidelines that have been established for the referral of matters to the panel require the matter to be referred to the panel, or members of the panel. I should say that there's a committee of the panel who oversees the work of the panel, but they're not personally involved in the referral of cases. So as it currently stands under our guidelines, potential litigants wanting to seek assistance need to apply to PILCH, And then they will go through the Pilch public interest test. And then if Pilch deem them a suitable candidate or has some questions about whether they fall between two stools or not and may be eligible for assistance, they will then refer the matter to two barristers. One of the things that we identified when we were setting up the panel is that there are a number of barristers, particularly younger barristers, possibly Gen Y barristers, who have an interest in environmental law but have never actually practiced in the area. So one of the things that we wanted to do is to broaden the depth of knowledge at the bar and to provide those particular people with the opportunity to expand their own knowledge. So the guidelines require the matter to be referred to two barristers, one with experience in the area, one without. So it might be a senior barrister and a junior barrister without experience, or the other way around. And then they will provide an advice on the merits and provide some strategic advice at that stage. And if the question is this a public interest matter, they will also consider that and then provide that advice and then continue acting if they deem it appropriate.
Great. That really clarifies it. And just so that our listeners are aware, PILCH is an acronym that we use all the time
it
in
is,
the law,
it?
But it stands for the Public Interest Law Clearinghouse, and that's what Jane was referring to. So obviously the panel itself, Jane, is a broader group of barristers. The committee is the sort of brains, if you like, or the operating force behind that panel, and PILCH is the third party that refers matters to you as a committee that would then go on to an appropriate barrister on the panel.
Certainly, and PILCH have been provided with the list of barristers so that the committee itself doesn't need to be involved in that referring process. There's also organisations like the Environmental Defenders Office who we're currently amending our guidelines to enable them to be able to refer matters directly, because they too have a public interest test that applicants for assistance must meet. So they too will have direct access to the list of barristers who are available to assist. I should say too that the committee, so that it's not, as it's not directly involved in the referral process, there is obviously other work that the panel seeks to do. We've run a highly successful lunchtime seminar program over the last 12 months looking at carbon offsets. And now my mind's gone blank. Simon Molesworth QC came and reported on the negotiations at COP15 in Copenhagen.
Oh, terrific.
So we've been trying to have a fairly current an up-to-date program. We most recent seminar was about the Climate Change Act that the state government introduced in the middle of last year. And we're hoping to continue a series of lectures in that regard.
That's fantastic. I mean, education is so important. As you were speaking then, Jane, I thought, gee, I didn't even know that there was a Climate Change Act that was introduced by the Victorian government.
By the Victorian government. And it sets a target of 20% capping of emissions by 2050. I think it is, and someone out there will no doubt say I'm wrong. I haven't actually read the Act in any great detail, but there is an Act, and it will seek to govern decision-making by government bodies going into the future.
So when we're looking at the sort of work that the panel might do in terms of an example, I mean, I think of anything from, damming issues in rural Victoria, use of land, zoning, whether or not it should be used for a particular purpose given that it's a high-risk flood area, through to potential cases, I suppose, involving companies that are polluting the environment through their carbon dioxide emissions. Is that the sort of work that's come across your desk in terms of what the panel's actually been presented with in its first, well, I suppose it's only been 6 months, hasn't it?
It has only been 6 months, and there have been a handful of matters that have been referred. There has been some advice provided in respect of the preservation of the avenue in Bacchus Marsh. I'm not sure if everyone's aware of the beautiful avenue that was created with oh, now my memory's going to test me. Old birches or
plane trees.
Plane trees, probably. So that was one area of advice. Mm. There was an injunction in relation to the Frankston bypass. And more recently, proceedings were commenced to seek review of the decision to enter into the desalination plant MOU, which was going to involve the exchange of law enforcement data, so people's criminal files, if you like, or not necessarily criminal files, but their personal information between the police and the developer of the desalination plant, Aquashore. So it's quite a broad range of matters that can be covered by the panel, and they're matters that have been referred to individual members of the panel.
Fantastic. And in terms of the sort of, I suppose, bigger picture law reform type agenda, does the panel work on policy initiatives or particular submissions to government?
There are three that have been undertaken. We put in a response to the recent review of the Environment Protection Authority's enforcement policies. Yeah. So we submitted a response to the list of questions it published. There are two other projects that we've got sort of on the boil. One is the making of a submission for a specialist land and environment court in Victoria so that we have a far better developed body of judicial authority so that we get greater certainty in decision-making in planning and environmental decisions. And the third that is quite exciting is to support a coalition that was established in England in 2008 for the establishment of an international court for the environment, which obviously would involve a huge amount of political will and a resulting international treaty. But these things don't happen without a force of will coming from a grassroots level internationally. So the panel's very keen to support that and to try and seek like support throughout Australia.
Fantastic. What sort of matters would come before a land and environment court, Jane, if we were to have one in Victoria?
I think the types of matters, it would obviously require fairly significant legislative change so that the court or a specialist list within one of our existing courts was given jurisdiction. So you might see that the EPA prosecutions would then take place in that single court. Or in New South Wales, they have a land and environment court where they hear the first instance planning decisions. So it could take the place of VCAT, or it may not take the place of VCAT, but be the place where the legal review, judicial review takes place.
Right. So it would be a very highly specialised
yes.
Court. Fantastic. I suppose one of the other questions I had, and I was just thinking outside the square a bit and wondering whether obviously working on a reduced fee or pro bono basis means that by and large you'll be working with those that are opposing government initiatives or trying to convince government perhaps that a certain development or a certain policy framework isn't working in the best interests of our environment. Does the panel work with government, and has the panel had any exposure to other industries like developers, planners, even architects? Has it got a bigger guise?
Not at this stage. I mean, individual members of the panel are, of course, members of the Victorian Planning and Environmental Law Association and have been informing their members of the existence of the panel. And one of the things on our list of things to do is to develop relationships with potential experts.
Fantastic.
In environmental matters, so the scientists and the planning specialists, engineers, those types of people. At this stage, we are fairly new and we're a small committee, so our ability to branch out hasn't been that great so far.
Just on the scientific side of things, Jane, do you think that the science of climate change and the debate that's gone on in terms of its potential impact, whether or not it's going to intensify floods and fires, will actually become part of the evidence that's led in court cases more and more as we see people having to be relocated, for instance, and litigation arise from those events?
It is actually difficult to say whether we will see that type of debate play out in the courts. Obviously, for many, it's a debate they'd like to see played out in the courts, because to have some judicial authority as to the causation of climate change would be of enormous benefit to everyone, and it would force our legislators to act. Having said that, you know, the panel is predominantly about access to justice and doesn't have a view one way or another in that regard. But look, it really depends on the type of action you're bringing. If you're looking at questions of tort, then you've got to look at questions of proportional liability and how do you determine that one coal-fired power station in Victoria, how do you determine the percentage of its contribution to a global problem? It's a very, very difficult question. There may be types of actions that will see the sites come in different ways. If you've got people who are representing that their products are clean energy products, or you know, we have the argument around clean coal. If someone wanted to challenge that type of argument, then there might have to be an analysis of whether the representations they're making are valid or not, and that's when the science would come in.
That's really fascinating. I wonder, Jane, whether you might be able to tell us whether or not any larger environmental discussion came up in the context of the Royal Commission on Bushfires, because I know that you were a barrister that was involved in that Royal Commission. Was there any broader debate, even if it was outside the inquiry, if you like, the formal boundaries of the inquiry, that came from the bushfires? I wonder whether there was, you know, a broader debate about what we're going to see in Australia around climate change.
The Commission heard evidence from Kevin Hennessy, who's a scientist at CSIRO and a climatologist, about the projections for Australian weather as a consequence of climate change. They identified that obviously the causes of climate change were not within their terms of reference, but in terms of planning for the future, they needed to take into account what the likely risk or increased risk of bushfire was to be. So that was certainly something that was addressed by the Royal Commission, and they accepted that bushfires would become more frequent and more intense, and therefore that formed the basis for many of their recommendations in terms of going forward. We also had some quite interesting panel discussions involving planning experts and also biodiversity experts, so that they could finally seek to find the balance between managing our natural environment and where we let people live and how we manage people living there.
Fantastic. Well, that's probably a good place on which to end it. And I think it's really timely that we've had this discussion, Jane, because one of the things that I picked up on in my reading this week was that the Tasmanian Charter has had quite a large focus, or the proposed Tasmanian Charter of Rights has had quite a large focus on sustainability and whether, in fact, there should be a right to a sustainable environment, and has really challenged what's a much more traditional approach taken by the Victorian Charter of Human Rights, which focuses, as we all know, mainly on civil and political rights, with some very, very small space given to economic, social and cultural rights. The Tasmanian Charter looks as though it's looking at these environmental issues and seeing the link between the environment and human rights, because I suppose the environment, and without a clean one, really determines how we enjoy our human rights as people.
Also, the ICE Coalition for the International Court of the Environment is envisaging a treaty that enshrines the right to a healthy environment, which picks up from the Rio convention from 1992.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming in, Jane. It was absolutely fascinating. And I think we've got a lot to learn in Australia about environmental law and rights. And I think we're going out with The Waifs. Evelyn, I think it's track 13 and it's from their Shiny Apple album. And I think the track itself is called Shiny Apple.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.